Howdy, everybody, and welcome to another BP Movie Journal, the show I do where I talk about the stuff that I've seen since the last time I did one of these. Let's start by addressing the elephant in the room. Yes, I am stuffed up. I have allergies. No, that's not the elephant in the room at all. The elephant in the room is the fact that keen listeners may have noticed there hasn't been a new episode in a couple weeks. Patrons, thank you for subscribing, patrons. Also might have noticed there's has not been a new Patreon. This will be fixed soon, and suddenly you'll have a windfall of episodes. Everything's okay, but there's a bunch of episodes that have been recorded that due to a weird issue I can't get to. It's a very fixable situation, but it's a situation that requires me and Tyler to be in the same room at the same time in order to fix, and I was out of town and he is, you know, mostly paralyzed in a hospital bed, so that has been difficult to orchestrate. So don't worry, the episodes are coming. Thank you for bearing with us. Thank you for the people who have reached out and asked if I was okay. I really do appreciate. I honestly, it's very touching and kind of embarrassing, but I'm glad that you cared. So anyway, that's what's going on. Expect those episodes soon. We have not actually missed a week, even though it feels like we have. It'll all catch up. You know, hopefully in the next week or so, you'll have a bunch of episodes. Sorry about this. This is just one of the weird difficulties of doing this, you know, in the situation that we are currently doing it and have been for over a year. There are just some things that pop up from time to time that would be more would be slight hiccups made worse by the fact that we can't Tyler and I can't be in the same room and function as we used to. So sorry about that, but let's jump in to the movies that I have seen since the last time I did one of these that I can talk about. I'm going to start with a small documentary called Roots of Fire, and this is directed by Abby Barrett Lavoie and Jeremy Lavoie. I don't know if they are married or otherwise related, but this is it's called Roots of Fire. Did I say that? It's called Roots of Fire. It's a documentary about Cajun music, but not, we get some history of Cajun music, but this is really more a snapshot of the Cajun music scene as it exists right now. So we get some of the really fascinating history of Cajun people and Cajun / Zydeco music, and Creole, and the differences, to the extent that there are differences between Cajun and Creole, is a fascinating thing that is talked about by a lot of the interviewees. Really, it's a portrait of a community in many ways. It's got a number of these musicians live in and around Lafayette, Louisiana, and they play there and they tour from there. They record there, but they also go, you know, they get nominated for Grammys in Roots regional Roots. I can't remember what the category is. But there's no specific Cajun or Zydeco category for the Grammys. Shockingly, there are so many Grammys that don't have a specific one. So they talk about being, you know, competing against, Native American music and Native Hawaiian music and stuff like that. And it's a portrait of a community. A huge part of it, in terms of like footage, not square footage, the footage used in the movie, is about Cajun Mardi Gras, which is different than New Orleans Mardi Gras, and also looks like, hey, look, they look like they're having a fun time. It seems like an absolute nightmare to me. A bunch of, like, it's cold, everyone's wearing costumes, walking and drinking from house to house, and collecting ingredients for the gumbo they're going to make, and then some people give them live chickens, and they have to chase the live chickens. So yeah, a bunch of drunk white folks in costume chasing chickens. It is just like, that is some backwoods shit that I love that they love it, but not for me. But I mean, the music, the movie is full of just great music, and some really interesting characters. So that's Roots of Fire. Next up, I filled in a blind spot. It is a blind spot I'm saying now, but I had always gotten the impression that John Carpenter's The Fog was seen as sort of like second tier Carpenter. I guess that it's, you know, around the same time as, you know, Halloween and The Thing and all these big ones that he made. So I watched The Fog for the first time, and this movie rocks. It's so good. It's definitely top tier in terms of John Carpenter's scores. Top tier in terms of movies shot by Dean Cundey, which is a lot of Carpenter movies from this period and a lot of other great movies. It's beautifully photographed and lit. You know, I'll talk about a movie later today that has a lot of dark sequences, and I think there's a lot of people who have complained about like movies being, Hollywood movies especially, being too dark these days. And like I said, we'll get to this later more, but I think part of the issue is that they're too dark overall, but never fully dark. Like the they're never true black in the shadows. And something like The Fog, with its largely nighttime story unfolding about ghost pirates. It's so cool. storming a New England town. A California town, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's California. The use of shadow and the things sort of suggested by the true darkness, it plays with your mind. The movie is just a delight to unfold, to watch unfold. After that, I watched, you know, I'd heard a lot of buzz, so I I'm very as you might know, I have a lot of lists, and I follow, I'm going to watch this, and I have I know what I'm going to watch for the next few days. But I went to friend of the show Sean Ingram's band's show. They're called Weird Spirit, and they check them out on all the streaming platforms. They're really good. I went to their show, and afterwards I was hanging out with them, and a couple of the band members were among many people I had heard talking about the Hulu movie No One Will Save You, directed by Brian Duffield. And I'd heard so much, I'd heard so many people buzzing about it, that I decided that night, went home and just threw it on. It's only an hour and a half, you know, it's an easy movie. So I made it that sort of like last minute impulse, like sort of audible, to change my viewing schedule for that night and watch No One Will Save You. And I'm glad I watched it, but it's also not, it feels like it never really takes off beyond the fun of its premise. And I don't want to give, for people who haven't seen it, I guess it's still new enough that there's still plenty of time left in October, in Halloween month, to watch it. So I don't want to give too much away about this sort of conceit in the way the movie unfolds, but the idea that it's a home invasion movie, but the invaders are aliens, and it's a single woman who's home alone, lives alone in a small community, the early going, there's a big thing that I'm not saying about how the story is told, it was fascinating, but also it took me like half an hour into the movie to realize, which I'm sure people who have seen it right now are probably laughing at me, but it took me I checked the thing, it was 33 minutes in, and I was like, huh, I see what's going on here. But there's also a sort of mystery element, and that this woman seems to not be very well liked in her town. I guess it feels like a movie that sets up a lot. It's got a great premise, and it doesn't botch the follow through on the premise, but it also doesn't offer much more beyond that. So I kind of, you know, even at 93 minutes, it kind of felt like it wore out its welcome a little bit and never quite lifted off the way I had hoped it would, especially for a movie that's getting so much buzz. Another horror movie I watched, directed by Leroy Kunz and Crew Ennis. It's called Deliver Us. The biggest name in the movie is Alexander Siddig. Basically it's about a Catholic priest who's on the verge of retiring, not because he has lost his faith. Usually Catholic priests in movies are undergoing some sort of crisis of faith. He has not lost his faith, but he has fallen in love and is going to leave, no longer be a man of the cloth, so that he can marry the woman he's fallen in love with. He's also, his role in the church, so I guess there's a little bit of a crisis of faith, because his role in the church is as an exorcist, and he doesn't believe, I don't know if he's full on saying that he doesn't believe in demonic possession, but he doesn't believe that any of the exorcisms he's conducted were real demonic possessions. But he's sort of sent out on one last job. It's a one last job type of movie, because a nun in a convent, and I can't remember what country it's supposed to be in, the character is American. He's played by one of the directors, Leroy Kunz, and he does a fine job, but I don't think you can kind of tell, I don't know, he's not quite at the level, I think, of the professional actors in the movie, although I guess he is a professional actor, but he's very handsome, I think that goes a long way. So he gets sent to a his boss says, get thee to a nunnery, a specific nunnery, where a nun is pregnant and claims it is immaculate conception. He's there to investigate. That's enough about the story, because that really is just the setup. It goes a lot of different places from there, and places that are a lot of fun. And I think, interestingly, I kind of just complained about No One Will Save You not having any real like surprises narratively, and I guess Deliver Us doesn't really, in terms of what happens, it doesn't do that much you haven't seen before in this genre, but it does it with such fervor and such sort of like kayfabe, like serious glee. Like this is ominous, but like everyone knows we're having a good time at the same time. And also with a just shocking amount of gore. The movie is like really gory. That I have to admit, I had a blast with Deliver Us. That's that. Next up, I watched the film I've been looking forward to for a long time, I think, since it premiered. I think it Sundance this year, CJ Obasi's Mamiwata, which takes place in a West African village where the sort of matriarch of the village is in her position because she claims that she can commune with this ocean spirit named Mamiwata, and but the village is behind its other villages in terms of modern conveniences. It doesn't have electricity, and it doesn't have its own like school and hospital supplies and stuff like that. And so there is a sort of mutiny or a rebellion stirring among mostly some young men who don't believe in Mami Wata. That's kind of the, and so they mount a rebellion. It feels very Shakespearean. That's what I thought a lot in terms of these, power moves and these warrior poet types who do a lot of like sort of, soliloquizing, and that's all very cool. The main thing, though, to recommend the movie is the cinematography by Lilis Suarez. It's black and white, and the people in this village, I don't know enough about the like specifics of like where in West Africa this is supposed to be, if these are the people in the village wear markings on their face, the different white either lines or dots, that I think again reminds me of why I thought of Shakespeare, even going even further back to like Greek tragedy, because everyone has like these masks and every character is sort of, it's not a really real mask, but it functions as a kind of mask, because even though their faces emote, they have the same pattern and each person has their individual pattern. So it works as a kind of mask, to identify, different characters, and you associate different sort of shapes of these designs, with different characters and their different motivations. It all looks like it looks very beautiful and in black and white, but it's also, this is not the movie I was gonna, there's another movie I'm gonna later that I'm gonna talk about, Darkness, but talk about a movie that is not afraid to embrace blackness, you know, the nighttime scenes. Like I said, there's no electricity here in this, and I'm not saying they shot it naturally, because the movie would be pitch black if that were true. Obviously there's some artificial light mimicking moonlight, but you know, there are scenes on the beach, because you know, this is a coastal village, there are scenes on the beach at night where like you can see the characters and you can hear the water, but you can't really make much else out, but in a way that feels very intentional and very stark, it feels like sort of art photography in a lot of ways. So yeah, Mami Wata, very good. Next up, two rewatches in a row. I rewatched Victor Arise's The Spirit of the Beehive, and I won't go into too much detail on it, actually, because I rewatched it because I discussed it on an episode of the What a Picture podcast, hosted by Brian Loomis and his wife, whose name I have... What? I talked to her for an hour and a half. What was her name? Maya? Shit. I feel like an asshole. But anyway, the podcast is called What a Picture. I got that name. That name right. Hannah. Her name is Hannah. I went on the What a Picture podcast, where they're jumping around talking about all the Sight and Sound top 100 movies, and they let me pick from the ones they hadn't done yet, and I love Spirit of the Beehive. I love a movie that is about movies, but not in a sort of like platitudinal way, like some movies like Cinema Paradiso, which I got some blowback on Twitter for talking shit about Cinema Paradiso on What a Picture. Spirit of the Beehive is a movie that is about the way that movies can unlock things, and stand for things and put things in motion, but it's also about family and politics and a lot of other things. So the Spirit of the Beehive, fantastic, really, what a picture. But yeah, listen to me talk about it on the What a Picture podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Next up, I rewatched a movie I've seen many, many times, but had not seen for close to 20 years, and that's Jonathan Demme's Stop Making Sense, which is newly restored and being released by A24. The last time there was any sort of restoration done was, I think, 99, maybe 98, 99. And they put out a widescreen VHS, letterboxed VHS. And I had that and I watched it a lot because I don't know if you know this about me, but Talking Heads, easily top five, maybe top two musical artists for me of all time, like musical acts. I've been an enormous Talking Heads fan since I was in ninth grade. I'm obsessed. So that's why I used to watch that VHS all the time at the end of, like, toward the end of high school there. But I hadn't watched it since. Yeah, watching it again, just especially in this new, beautiful, crisp restoration, continued to just be the... This is a cold, ice-cold take, but a lot of people say it's the best concert film of all time, and I will say it is certainly the best one I've ever seen. It feels almost impossible, even sitting in the movie theater, not to clap at the end of every song, and I kind of did actually a few times clap. I did not quite stand up and dance, but there were people in the theater who did stand up and dance, and I don't blame them. I was not mad at them for that. But I think maybe the reason it has this reputation and earns this reputation as the best concert film of all time is A, the music is great. It's visually great, like the performances, you know, David Byrne has like some sort of dances that he does, but also he's got, in addition to Tina Weymouth and Jerry Harrison and Chris France, they've got Steve Scales and Alex Weir and Bernie Worrell, and that especially like Alex Weir and Steve Scales are like so lively on stage and are clearly having a fun time. Everyone looks like they're having fun the whole time. The two backup singers, Edna and what is it, Louise? I can't remember. You know what? It's Lynn. I knew it started with an L. Okay. Everyone just looks like they're having such a fun time. That's a big part of it, but also the fact that this is not, unlike your standard concert movie, this is not I don't think of it as a documentary because it's not a concert that was filmed. It's they put on the concert to film it, and it did, I think, two performances, and it was made for the camera first, and that's just fascinating. And Jonathan Demme knows exactly not just what he knows how to edit it together. He's in terms of, he clearly loves music. He made other music documentaries. And we always seem to be during the song, looking at the thing that is most, that we want to be looking at the moment that it's happening. You know, you want to see, if you were just listening to the music and imagining it, you'd be like, I want to see Tina playing the bass in heaven. I want to see Burning Worrell doing the keyboards in This Must Be the Place, you know, when he shows you exactly what you would want to see. Beautiful stuff, beautiful stuff. And then, okay, the next four, which are the last four movies I'm going to talk about, I watched on the plane. So normally I don't watch movies on planes because normally they're edited. But on the way to, I was in London, by the way. That's where I saw Stop Making Sense, too. It was at the Screen on the Green in London, in the neighborhood of Islington, or the borough of Islington, I guess. So normally I don't like to watch movies on, I like to read or sleep, mostly sleep, on planes. But my wife, Natalie, my wife, you guys know Natalie. Natalie watched, on the way to London, watched No Hard Feelings and said that it was like completely uncut, you know, full frontal nudity and all of that stuff. That's a movie that you could tell, you know, you'd know if it were censored. So I decided, hell, I'm going to use my 10.5-hour flight on the way back to catch up on some 2023 movies that I haven't seen. And so I started with a couple long ones. I watched Beau Is Afraid, which I think is almost certainly... I think it's my favorite Ari Aster film so far. But also, if you know my opinions from listening to this podcast, that's not saying a whole hell of a lot. I didn't like Hereditary. I found a lot of progress in him, a lot of growth in Midsommar. There are a lot of things about Midsommar that I like. I could even see myself, that's why I hesitate to say Beau's Afraid is my favorite, because I could see myself rewatching Midsommar, even though I think it has some of the same problems as Hereditary, in terms of kind of not sticking the landing. And Beau Is Afraid has the same problem of not sticking the landing, but it's 3 hours long, and it's so enjoyable up until then. I mean, enjoyable seems like obviously you're listening to this podcast, you know, like what I mean. I'm not saying it's, you know, The Wizard of Oz or anything. It's like, it's very tense and uneasy, but it's also strange. I would say it's definitely the funniest Ari Aster film. There is some stuff in there that made me laugh out loud on the plane. There's a serial killer that the news Chiron refers to as Birthday Boy Stab Man. I don't even say any more than I'm not even going to say any more than that. Just the idea that like Birthday Boy Stab Man is out terrorizing the public with these random killings. There's some other very funny stuff in a strange way. And so I was like, yeah, for the first 2+ hours, I was like, this is great. This is a really big step ahead. But then once again, it gets to the ending, and I feel like Ari Aster just, in this case, I feel like the third act becomes just increasingly obvious, and then becomes louder and louder in its obviousness. In a way that that turned me off. The very end has all that obviousness, but at least the movie has a great performance from Joaquin Phoenix throughout. So it might be a while before I watch it again, because it's 3 hours long and I don't like a big chunk of the end leaves a bad taste in my mouth. But I'm definitely glad I watched that on the plane, I'm definitely glad I watched it, just period. Next up, another movie that I didn't realize going in was nearly 3 hours long. I finally caught up with John Wick Chapter 4, and this is I will always have a place in my heart for the first one, so I will say this is the best one since the first one, but it might actually be the best one, but easily the best one since the first one. It could have been longer, as far as I'm concerned, because I was thinking about, like, comparing the run times. I was thinking about the differences between the Raid or the Raid Redemption and Raid 2, and how Raid 2 is like an hour longer than the Raid, but doesn't have any more action than the Raid. It just added an hour of kind of turgid drama that kind of kept the momentum from building. John Wick Chapter 4, yeah, being and over an hour longer than the first John Wick, doesn't have that problem. It is just wall to wall. There's so little real story here. There's just wall to wall. Like there's a part, you know, when we're clearly like about to gear up for the final battle, but there's an hour left in the movie, and I was like, what are they gonna do? I was foolish to wonder how they pad out that hour. John Wick just like fights a bajillion guys, and all of it so great. It's so fun to look at. It's so well choreographed. Also, the series has been so great at introducing like supporting characters who are fascinating, and in this case, Donnie Yen shows up as a blind assassin who, like John Wick in the first movie, has retired but is like sort of forced back into the life, and he's both like a, you know, because there's this like sort of brotherhood of assassins, but part of being an assassin means that they had to kill each other. So Kane, Donnie Yen's character, is both a pal and an antagonist at the same time. I'm going to say right now Donnie Yen for best supporting actor. So that's John Wick. Next up, I watched M. Night Shyamalan's Old. Sorry, I had already seen Old. I watched M. Night Shyamalan's Knock at the Cabin, which I was eager to see because the last M. Night Shyamalan movie was Old, and I really liked Old a lot. Knock at the Cabin is definitely a come down from Old. I don't think it's bad. M. Night Shyamalan has such skills and such artistry in mood and storytelling that it's hard for him to make a bad movie. There was a time that was a controversial statement, actually. I forget that. And I'm guilty of it too, because I actually, now that I say it, I still don't really like The Village, and I know I'm wrong. I'm sorry. But yeah, Knock at the Cabin. I think the difference, this feels like a trend on this movie journal, is that there's a big surprise that comes having to do with Rupert Grint's character fairly early on. And I think, but after that, it's kind of established, like, okay, so this is the path the movie's going to take, and then it just keeps doing it. So you kind of, like, you kind of see it coming. It's still moody and great performances from the whole cast. Abby Quinn is in it. I feel like I hadn't seen her in anything in a while, but I like her. Ben Aldridge was the one who was like kind of new to me. He and Jonathan Groff play the married couple at the center of the movie. He's really good. There's definitely a lot to keep it going, but it's like, I think The Fog might not be second tier Carpenter, but I do think Knock at the Cabin is second tier Shyamalan. And then finally, so I finished Knock at the Cabin. I realized I still had almost 2 hours left in the flight. So I was like, what can I watch? So I was like, oh, I'll watch Blackberry. Nope. That one's 2 hours, just a little over, I think. And I was like, you know what? Animated movies tend to be short. Why don't I finally catch up on Across the Spider-Verse? Fucking 2 hours and 20 minutes. So I didn't watch that. So I was just like looking at what was new and short. And that led me to Scott Beck and Brian Woods' 65. Yes, the movie where Adam Driver shoots at dinosaurs. This feels like a movie that was kind of made to watch on an airplane. You don't really have to pay very close attention to the story. It's very simple and kind of dumb, but also kind of like surprisingly dumb. I don't know how much. I'm trying to figure out like what was known about it. I guess I had assumed, okay, I'm going to give something away that I think people probably know that I just didn't. I had assumed it was a time travel movie, like Sound of Thunder type of deal where Adam Driver goes back in time. No, Adam Driver is not a human. He's an alien from a planet that is like concurrent with 65 million years ago. So this is his present, but he crash lands on prehistoric Earth where there's dinosaurs. The escape pod breaks off the ship and lands 15 kilometers away. There's one other survivor, a cute little tyke, who doesn't speak the same language. Which I know you're thinking of like Midnight Sky. God, hopefully you're not thinking of Midnight Sky. Hopefully you weren't subjected to Midnight Sky. It has kind of a Midnight Sky plot, in that he has to get across a dangerous terrain with a small child who doesn't understand him, but it's a much better movie than that. But what's so that's the plot, that he has to get across 50 kilometers of killer dinosaurs with this child to get to the escape vessel. But then they add another thing, which is that his, like, I don't know, radar device or whatever you call it, picks up that there's a huge asteroid, a monstrous, like, planet-killing asteroid headed for. So yes, he has managed to land on Earth less than 48 hours before the asteroid that is going to destroy the dinosaur life. That's so silly, but it's also like, okay, that's just fun. It's a fun twist. It's a fun heightening of the plot. And the movie also, like, the Scott Beck and Brian Woods have a couple of cool ideas with, you know, using lightning to suddenly reveal a dinosaur we didn't know was there. Or there's one part where, and it's almost hard to explain, but he's got this little like thing that looks like those like old portable DVD player like things, but it like scans the dark cave in front of him and can tell you where their life forms, and he ends up getting into a fight with a dinosaur, and that thing falls on the ground pointed at them. So for a part of the fight, we're not watching them, we're just watching the two holograms of them on the little screen thing fight, which is like super cool. But this is the movie that I'm talking about that has that thing of like, even when they're in a cave, like there's no part of the screen is really black, everything's just kind of like blue tinted, I guess. And that feels very like one of my least favorite things about the present day look of movies. But it's still fun. It's got some really dumb dialogue. There's a part early on before he's at the crash site and he's looking for this escape pod that broke off the ship, and the ship's computer is like speaking in like the, you know, woman computer voice and saying like, searching for escape vessel, location undetected. And Adam Driver looks at the screen and goes, "Where are you?"